Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for standing by. Welcome to the ICN webinar conference call. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session. Should you require assistance on today's call, or if you'd like to ask a question, please press star and then zero. As a reminder, this conference is being recorded. I'd now like to turn the conference over to our host, Mr. Eldon Avetz. Please go ahead.
Thank you very much. This is Eldon Avetz of the U.S. Federal Trade Commission. We're delighted to welcome everyone to the fourth webinar of the Unilateral Conduct Working Group of the International Competition Network. Today, our program will feature two presentations, two case studies on price discrimination, an increasingly important issue in competition policy. Those two presentations will follow an introductory discussion, description of the topic. The introductory description will be by way of slides, as will the presentations. The introductory discussion of the topic is by Professor Damien Gerardin, partner Covington and Burling in Brussels, and professor of competition law. After he speaks, we'll have the opportunity for questions and answers with the audience. Following that, there will be a presentation on a South African case study by Trudy Makhaya, senior analyst for the South African Competition Commission. And following her presentation, there will be questions and answers. And the third presentation and the second case study will be by Mr. Vladimir Kachalin, assistant to the president, FAS, Russia. We will be assisted in our questions by two commentators who are, Radoslav DePolo, who's a judge of the Chilean Competition Tribunal. And we will also be assisted by Felix Engelsing, who's a senior manager with the German Cartel Office and an active participant in ICN Matters. And let me emphasize that you can follow the presentations, the slides online, and the entire program will be available online at the ICN's website for analysis and study following the program. Damien, would you care to kick things off?
Yes, thank you very much, Eldon, for giving me the opportunity to speak in this webinar. What I'd like to do in the next few minutes is to give a short introduction on the economics of price discrimination. My experience with price discrimination essentially relates to the European Union, but to the extent that I will focus on the economics of the matter, I think what I say is applicable to all jurisdictions. So first of all, price discrimination is a complex issue. It's certainly one of the most complicated area of competition law I've had to deal with these last few years. And I think it's complicated for the following reasons. First, price discrimination covers many different practices, including discount and rebates, bundling, selective price cuts, or discriminatory input prices set by vertically integrated operators. And the objective and effects on competition of these different practices may differ. In fact, if you think at, pricing abuses, most forms of pricing abuses contain an element of price discrimination. So it is a multifaceted concept. Secondly, there's a consensus among economists that the welfare effect of price discrimination are ambiguous. It is hard to say a priori, like it would be, for example, in the cartel field where you can say it's always bad, but in this case it's hard to say whether a given form of price discrimination increases or decreases welfare, the response to that question may depend on which types of welfare standards you're actually pursuing. Now, what is price discrimination? So is there a legal definition of price discrimination? And I'm afraid there's none. Economists have tried to give some content to the notion of price discrimination, and one definition that I find particularly helpful is the definition provided by Richard Posner in his antitrust book, in which he says, price discrimination is a term that economists use to describe the practice of selling the same product to different customers at different prices, even though the cost of sale is the same to each of them. More precisely, it is selling at a price or prices such that the ratio of price to marginal cost is different in different sales. So I think it's a good definition because it gives an objective criterion to identify price discrimination, but it also shows that it's not because you actually offer different prices to different customers that you are engaging in anti-competitive price discrimination. A classic example of this can be found in the licensing area, where a licensor may ask for the same set of patents, may ask a 2% royalty in a given case, and may ask a 5% royalty in another case without actually discriminating, simply because in the first case there will be a very valuable cross-license, whereas in the second case there's no cross-license. Therefore, it is not surprising that the royalty demanded by the licensor are higher in that second case, and there's nothing to say about that. Now, after the definition, let's look at the conditions for price discrimination to occur. Well, I think that three conditions must be present for price discrimination to occur. First, a firm must have some market power to be able to price discriminate, because otherwise it cannot succeed in charging any consumer above the competitive price. I mean, obviously, if you're in a highly competitive market, you're unlikely to see much price discrimination, whereas in a market where a firm has significant market power, then that firm will be able to discriminate. Secondly, the firm in question must have the ability to sort consumers depending on their willingness to pay for each unit. So, for instance, in the airline industry, as it is well known, flights will be sold at different prices to different customers because airlines will usually identify the sort of customers you are and will be able to squeeze as much money from you. Finally, and that's very important, although sometimes overlooked, in order to have price discrimination, the firm discriminating must be able to prevent or limit resale of the goods or services in questions by consumers paying the lower price to those who pay the higher price. So, for instance, if you're selling medicine at different prices in two different jurisdictions, that will only work provided that the consumers in the low-price jurisdictions are not able to resell the product, and in the high-price jurisdiction, that very often leads pharmaceutical companies to adopt measures in order to prevent parallel trade. Now, let's look at the different forms of price discrimination. Well, price discrimination has typically one objective, which is to capture as much consumer surplus as possible. That is clearly the case if you think about airlines, as I mentioned in my prior example. But this can be achieved through different means, and economists have identified three main means of price discrimination. First, you have so-called first-degree price discrimination, which occurs when a firm is able to perfectly discriminate between consumers. In other words, when it enjoys the ability to charge the maximum each consumer is willing to pay for each unit of a given product. Needless to say that first-degree price discrimination is rare, because it is rare that companies have that sort of perfect information about their customers. Second-degree price discrimination is much more frequent. In fact, you see it all the time. It occurs when a firm sets a price per unit which varies with the number of units the customer buys. So a great example, or a classic example, is volume discounts or rebates, where if you buy a large number of units, you'll be given a better price than if you buy a small number of units. That is a classic business practice, which, of course, can lead in some circumstances to anti-competitive issues. And finally, third-degree price discrimination, which occurs also quite frequently, takes place when a firm charges different prices to different groups of consumers depending on their elasticity of demand, which is a fairly logical thing to do if you're a firm with market power. In other words, you will charge more to those who have a high elasticity of demand. In other words, that are likely unlikely to shift their products. So the problem with these different forms of price discrimination is that they're not necessarily useful for competition law analysis, because they don't say that much about the impact of these different forms of price discrimination have on competition in the market. So a more relevant distinction for competition law analysis is based on a distinction between primary line and secondary line injury. Primary line injury is typically occasioned by the dominant firms to its competitors by applying different prices to its own customers. So let me give you an example. One way to exclude competitors is by giving loyalty rebates to your own customers to make it such that it will be unattractive for them to buy quantities from other suppliers. Selective price cuts is another example where you may give a better price to customers that are particularly vulnerable because they may be actually quite willing to buy from other suppliers. So that's primary line injury to your competitors. And then you have secondary line injury, which is imposed on one of several customers to the dominant firm against one or several other customers. Price discrimination, in the strict sense of the term, essentially relate to secondary line injury. In fact, primary line injury will typically trigger the application of legal tests that are specific to the conduct in questions, for example, in EU law, but I suspect it's true in other jurisdictions. You may have different tests for discounts and rebates, or tying and bundling, and so on and so forth. So when we speak strictly of price discrimination, we're actually talking about secondary line injury. So let me finish this introduction by focusing on secondary line injury. Well, secondary line injury may occur in two different types of scenarios. One which is very frequent, which is discriminatory pricing by vertically integrated operators. So that's the classic form of vertical foreclosure whereby, for instance, a vertically integrated telecommunications operator will charge a discriminatory price in order to create a competitive disadvantage for its downstream competitors. That is very frequent, and that is, of course, the sort of practices that will fall off competition rules. In most jurisdictions, however, this sort of conduct will not be seen mainly as price discrimination, but more as anti-competitive leveraging. So, in fact, if you really want to isolate, you know, price discrimination, you have to focus on the second category of secondary line injury, which relate to discriminatory pricing by non-vertically integrated competitors. This is, of course, a very rare scenario because non-vertically integrated operators have no real incentives to place one of their customers at a competitive disadvantage. There are three reasons for that. First, upstream firms benefit from a competitive downstream market for distributing their goods. If you're suppliers and you have different distributors, you will typically benefit from tough competition between these distributors, as it will reduce the markup they charge, and therefore you can squeeze more rents from the product you distribute. Secondly, an upstream firm discriminating between distributors may discourage them to distributing its products because they will be concerned about discrimination and therefore may see that supplier as a sort of unreliable partner. Finally, discrimination among buyers may lead to the exclusion of the discriminated purchasers and increased concentration on the purchasing market, which in fact will create countervailing buyer power and therefore make the life of the supplier more difficult. So if you have three distributors and you give a competitive advantage to one and the two others disappear, then you have you face monopoly at the distribution level, which of course is not exactly what you're looking for. So let me finish by saying that if you look at the European Union, there are many cases that are labeled as price discrimination cases, but in fact they're not price discrimination cases. They're cases about leveraging or their rebate cases, but the reason why they've been historically labeled as price discrimination is because the word discrimination looks bad, and therefore for the European Commission it's been a sort of tool to make some practices look worse than they actually are. Now, are they, you know, is it impossible to foresee scenarios where you could have a true price discrimination, that is, price discrimination by non-vertically integrated operators? No, you can see some scenarios. A classic one is buyer power. You've got three buyers, and one has a lot of buyer power and forces you to give better prices, better treatment. But of course, that should not be an infringement on the part of the supplier, because the supplier is forced to give these better prices. There's nothing it can do about it. That's something that is often forgotten in rebate cases. Secondly, there could be an instance where a supplier may have an incentive to discriminate among buyers, that is, when it faces a tight oligopoly among its purchaser. In that case, giving a preference to one of the oligopolists may trigger a deviation from the collusive outcome, which should be, at the end of the day, beneficial for both the end customers, but also the supplier. So I will stop here, and of course I'm willing to take some questions.
And ladies and gentlemen, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star and then zero. You'll hear an acknowledgement tone, and an operator will then take your name and further instruct you. If you're using a speakerphone, please pick up the handset before pressing numbers. Once again, if you have a question, please press star zero at this time. Okay. And there are currently no questions in queue. And Mr. Abbott, your line is open.
Hi, yes, this is Andrew Heimer from the Federal Trade Commission, and I had a question about the definition of price discrimination, which requires selling the same product. And in the airline example you provided, as well as a patent license and any more probably in services provision, there seems to be a question as to whether one might be licensing or selling the same product or a different product. For example, one might characterize an airline ticket that comes with significant limitations, advanced purchase requirements, and restrictions on refundability to be a different product than an airline ticket that allows for a complete refund and can be purchased the day before a flight.
Well, sure.
How
I think
evaluate whether something is the same product being sold at a different price or if it is a different product being sold at a different price?
Yes, I think that's a good question. I think you can see both. You can see, you know, different products sold at the same price and same products sold at different prices. If you think about airlines, indeed, if you buy a business class ticket, it is logical that the price is higher. You will pay a different price because you get a better service. But at the same time, I think you can pay very different prices for exactly the same business ticket simply because you come from a different country, because you're a regular customer, and so on and so forth. If you think about a classic example of price discrimination, is discrimination based on age. For example, if you go to the movie, under 12-year-old will pay $6, whereas an adult will pay $8, and a pensioner will pay $4. So you can see a lot of that. In my licensing example, typically you buy the same product. You buy, you know, your access to a set of patents. The only thing, of course, is that, you know, you will pay a higher or lower prices depending on one you offer in return. So you can pay in cash and you can pay in kind. I think the essential observation is that it is not because you pay different prices for the same product that there is necessarily price discrimination.
Oh, thank you. Let me ask, would Radoslav de Polo of the Chilean Competition Tribunal care to comment on Damien's presentation?
Yeah, thanks, Alvin. I have three short comments and maybe one question. If you look at the case law in the last 40 years in relation to price discrimination, you will see that the concept or the definition of price discrimination has been narrowed to what Damien has told us to be today, price discrimination. Just remember the first cases, mainly the Salt case, in Morton Salt case in the U.S., when just a different pricing was defined and considered as an unlawful discrimination. So this has been a long run up today, and the definition has been narrowed to very strict borders. But nevertheless, we also have been facing here in Chile troubles with the definition, mainly because claimants, for example, usually are confused between different conducts that look like price discrimination or that involve a kind of discrimination. So, for example, the boundaries between margin squeeze, predatory pricing, refusal to deal, and price discrimination are not clear. So tracing a line to separate such conducts, and to assess them in their own merit is quite difficult sometimes, because the claimants also present the evidence according to their own confusion. So you have to sort out what are they trying to tell you, and then you have to make your decision. So I think that I would like to ask a question to them. What would be a general, you know, thumb rule to make a separation between these conducts first? And second, I have a question in relation to the three conditions outlined in your presentation, that is market power, consumer sorting, and limitation of resales. Because I understand that if these three conditions are met, we are looking at a case of price discrimination, but that does not mean that particular price discrimination is unlawful. And there's a lot of confusion also in relation to that. Which cases are unlawful and which not? And in the case of non-vertically integrated discriminators, we can also have a series of situations in which, by a reason of grade, for example, you may have an unlawful discrimination and in others not. So I would like to ask also, Damien, as a second question, is there any general approach to start understanding which cases are unlawful? What should we look at to ascertain that? Thank you.
Okay, well, these are two great questions. So let me start with the first, which means, you know, how do you sort of work out the boundaries between different practices, such as margin squeeze, predatory pricing, and so on and so forth? Well, the reason why I have a narrow definition of price discrimination is because I think that in very many instances, either plaintiffs or competition authorities use the label price discrimination without really specifying what it is or why it is price discrimination. You know, in a complaint, it always looks good to say that there is some form of discrimination. I've been discriminated against. So, you know, in EU law, I think it is important because you may have different legal bases. So, you know, my temptation is to say, well, if the problem is a problem of loyalty rebates, well, let's look at this problem under the test for loyalty rebates. If it's a problem of mixed bundling, let's use the test for mixed bundling, and let's call this mixed bundling, and so on and so forth. Now, of course, if you take the example of EU law, that is quite practicable because these different forms of abuses, you know, have been rather neatly identified by the European Commission and the EU courts. For example, in a recent case that will be discussed actually at the end of this webinar, the Telia-Sonera case, the Court of Justice made it very clear that margin squeeze was a distinct abuse, which is exactly the opposite of what the Supreme Court said in Lindlein. So for me, you know, the best approach when there's a claim of price discrimination is first to see what it is and then apply the right test for that behavior instead of trying to muddle it and say, well, it's price discrimination, so it's bad, which is very often a claim that is made. Secondly, with respect to the sort of narrow definition of price discrimination and you know, can you develop a theory to distinguish between pro-competitive price discrimination and anti-competitive price discrimination? So first of all, I think what is critical is to avoid any per se rule. You know, price discrimination is generally used for good reasons, okay? Because both firms with market power and firms without market power engage in price discrimination. So there must be some efficiencies. In some cases, you may have exclusionary motives, but most of the time, it's pro-competitive, okay? So that's rule number one. Rule number two, you have to do an effects-based analysis. And then, I think that, again, for me, the starting point is to identify what you're talking about. Are you talking about a problem of rebates? Are you talking about a problem of selective price cuts? Are you talking about margin squeeze? And so on and so forth, because then you have a test, and if it's a good test, it will always balance, you know, efficiencies and competitive harm. Now, is there a test for price discrimination as a whole? Well, you may have one, but again, I think it should be some sort of rule of reason. If there is price discrimination, it doesn't fall under any particular pigeonhole, then you have to do a rule of reason analysis, or in the context of EU law, an Article 101, Paragraph 3 analysis, whereby you look at the pros and the cons. If the cons are heavier than the pros, then you should ban it.
Thank you very much for that clarification, Damien. I think right now we should turn to Trudy Makaya of the South African Competition Commission to discuss the Nationwide Polls case and a new set of slides.
Hi, thank you, Damien. I'm going to be talking about the Nationwide Polls case in South Africa. It was a case that was heard a few years ago. In both by the tribunal and Competition Appeals Court. So I think I'll just go directly to slide 15. So the product in question was a product called creosote that Nationwide Polls used in its manufacturing and treatment of polls, and these polls were used in vineyards. And this product was actually a byproduct from two companies, Sasol and Suprachem, which were producing respectively liquid fuels and steel, and they sold this byproduct to pole manufacturers such as Nationwide Poles. There was actually another chemical called CCA that could also be used for treating poles, but it was found that it wasn't suitable for treating poles in vineyards for various health and safety reasons. And the essence of the complaint was that Nationwide realized that it was being charged a higher price than its most competitor and all other competitors. And it does and therefore it solicited the price list from Sasol and discovered that indeed it was being charged a different price. And we will get into the pricing later. Now, in terms of the sequence of events on the next slide, in terms of the sequence of events, basically Nationwide Polls approached the Competition Commission, and its complaint was non-referred, and therefore it had recourse to directly approach the adjudicating body, the Competition Tribunal, to lodge its complaint. Now, this is a very important fact because it then had a bearing on the kind of evidence that was placed in front of the tribunal. Because from what we can tell, the commission at the time, this was like about 19 years ago, it was still a young institution, and there had really seemed to have been limited investigation and limited evidence that had been gathered. And Mr. Foote, the owner of Nationwide Polls, went ahead to the tribunal without the benefit of the commission's investigative power. So he couldn't summon the industry and put in investigate in the same way that a commission could. Nonetheless, the tribunal found in his favor and found that there had been prohibited price discrimination, but then this was overturned by the Competition Appeal Court, which then found in favor of Sasol. And this really turned on whether there had been a substantial lessening or prevention of competition, and the appeals court felt that this hadn't been demonstrated. The court found in favor of Sasol, and eventually in 2005, Nationwide Poles exited the market. Now, in terms of the pricing in question, the next slide, if you look at the price list, I mean, I won't go into detail, but the basic essence, if you look there, is that if you're a customer of Sasol, you are placed in a price band. And this was based on your previous year's sales. You were placed in a certain price band given your volume. And then this would then be revised every 3 months. So if you deviated significantly from what you've done next year, this, you would then be placed in a different band. The point being that if you're in the lowest price band, you paid 19.5%, between 18 to 19.5% more than if you had been in the highest volume band. And from what could be seen from the evidence, there wasn't, you know, even people in the buyers in the smallest band received the product in the same way that buyers in the highest band received the product. So there wasn't really a different mode of delivery or any other clear economies that could be determined from this. And also, it's important to know that this was based on historical sales volumes and not on actual sales volumes. So a cost justification would actually be quite difficult to sustain. And also, the pricing bans were only revealed to Nationwide Poles during its investigation or its initial complaint to the commission. So this wasn't transparent. This wasn't something that was well known in the industry. Now, going to the next slide, you know, I think the point should be made that even, you know, in South Africa, price discrimination in the South African Act has to meet various requirements. First, I think, you know, going back to Damien's point, it has to be a dominant firm. In the South African law, if you've got a market share over 45%, there's a presumption of dominance. The price discrimination, the conduct has to have the effect of substantially preventing or lessening competition. The transactions have to be shown to be equivalent. They have to be comparable or equivalent in somehow, going back to almost the airline ticket example. You know, it has to be one business class ticket compared to another. It can't be simply that the transactions are not equivalent. It has to be discrimination in terms of price or discounts, provision of services, or payment for services provided. In this case, it was clearly in the form of a discount. And a respondent has access to various defenses that they can use to justify their differential pricing. So differential pricing, you know, per se is not legal if you can claim that, you know, there's different allowances being made for different costs, meeting competition, et cetera. And there's also no penalty for a first offense. And so far, we've only really had one case, one substantial case of price discrimination that has been heard through our court. So it's also quite a bit of an unusual, you know, it's not a usual contravention that you would find. So then going on to the next slide in terms of the relevant market and dominance, there actually wasn't much debate, as I mentioned, between the various courts on this. The market was found to be for creosote, that substance that they used to treat coal. And in that market, Sasol was found to be dominant. There were also other examples. Other than just its market share, there were clear examples where, in certain instances, it had, like, exorbitant price increases without any real recognition of its customers or competitors. So there was clear instances of very independent behavior. The only issue was that there was another competitor in the market, Suprachem, but it was argued, especially at the tribunal, that it wasn't an effective constraint on Sasol's behavior. First of all, it had very limited production capacity. Sasol didn't seem to take it into account in its pricing, and it seemed to follow Sasol. However, in the Competition Appeals Court, even though Sasol's dominance was not really questioned, There were questions as to whether there had been enough evidence on the role of SupraChem in the market and its ability to be a reasonable alternative for creosote producers. But in general, as you know, the market was found to be for creosote, and SUSO was found to be dominant. Now, going on to the next slide, as I mentioned earlier, the real debate in this case was on the substantial lessening and prevention of competition. And, you know, it was linked very much to the kinds of evidence that the owner of Nationwide Ports had been able to provide. So the tribunal, in its ruling, found or argued that, in fact, a competitor, a small competitor like Nationwide Ports, had to show the competitive relevance of its complaint, but being a small business, it was unlikely to be able to show generalized harm to the market. So substantial was really, in the Act, they interpreted substantial to just mean that you had to show that this, you know, you weren't just an end consumer who wasn't disadvantaged versus other competitors. You know, there had to be a distinction between, you know, they said there had to be a distinction between the trivial and the weightier. But then at the same time, as a small business, you weren't expected to show harm that you know, would not be possible given the size that you are within that market. The tribunal also went into detail about various public interest arguments that the Act clearly has small business in mind in having a separate provision for price discrimination, and that substantial lessening and prevention of competition should therefore be viewed within that context. Of course, when they talked about competitive relevance, they still referred back to other competitors and said, from what we can tell from Nationwide, similarly situated small firms and entrants would also be discriminated against and will also suffer harm. So they didn't. Competitive relevance wasn't saying that only look at Nationwide polls. There was just a sense that you can look at one competitor, and if that evidence is valid, you can generalize to a class of small competitors that would suffer from a similar kind of harm. In terms of incentives for SUSO to engage in this behavior, especially you know, in the context of secondary line harm, the only real evidence that could be seen was that there had been lobbying from the pole manufacturer industry. Previously, for example, they had asked SUSO to discriminate against micro producers who they felt should not be in the industry. So it wasn't so much that there was necessarily exclusionary intent by SUSO at any level. It was more the industry of buyers itself being organized enough and, you know, having old boys networks, etc., so that they were able to lobby SUSO to price in a certain way. Next slide. So, in essence, the tribunal then, based on those public interest arguments and on Nationwide Ports having shown the competitive relevance of the claim, found that there was material differentiation between the most and the least favored in terms of volume and price premiums paid, to the tune of about 19%, and that it was likely that similarly situated firms and new entrants would also be less effective competitors due to this conduct, especially in a market where it was felt that actually small businesses could thrive. In general, the barriers to entry weren't so high. Absent the price discrimination, there could actually be effective competition in that market. SUSO didn't really make a case for any of the defenses that were available to it, partly because there just wasn't evidence on it linking its pricing to any form of cost measure. And so it was found that the conduct substantially lessened or prevented competition in the respondent market. Now, at the appeals court, on the next slide, at the appeals court then, as mentioned earlier, the ruling of the tribunal was overturned in that it was found that the burden of proof had actually not been discharged. Evidence had been clearly shown that in terms of Nationwide's own cost structure, it had, you know, a 3.5, you know, percent or so higher cost, and for a small business with thin margins, this was clearly detrimental to its own margins. And yet it was felt that one couldn't generalize from this one experience to the ability of small producers in general to compete. The appeals court gave various examples of the kinds of things that they would have liked to have seen to be able to say that, you know, Nationwide Poll's experience could be generalized. They would have liked to have seen evidence on exit. They would have liked to see evidence of the cost structures of other small firms in the market. And they also made the point that at least at the time, Nationwide Poll had been able to compete and to continue to operate in the market. They also felt there was insufficient evidence on Cecil's competitor, Suprachem. And in their view, the tribunal's ruling was tantamount to protecting competitors instead of protecting competition, whereas the tribunal had thought that from Nationwide Poll's experience, you could generalize to a class of similar situated competitors or buyers. So in that sense, it was felt by the appeals court that actually a substantial lessening of competition had not been provided, at least on the evidence that was presented to the court. There's been some writing on this case, and an alternative view has emerged as to potentially how price discrimination could be looked at, given that in certain instances it will be most impact. It would have the most impact on small businesses. And there's been writings by a scholar and advocate named Peterson, who's argued that actually if you read closely into the Act, it talks about prevention or lessening of competition. And that lessening of competition might mean that a complainant has to show a full market analysis. A prevention of competition could simply mean an impediment that's placed in the way of a competitor. And if that impediment is such that the competitor is unable to be an effective rival in a market, whatever it is that's standing in the way that hinders and impedes that competitor could be seen to be preventing competition in the market in general. So that kind of flips that whole saying of protecting competitors and competition and then saying, well, without competitors, there can't be competition. So if competitors are prevented from being competitive, that should be enough to show a prevention of competition. And Peterson also refers to the EU and also goes back to Morton Salt to say that, you know, it shouldn't, the standard should be about prevention because you want to stop the discrimination before it leads into a general, generalized harm into the market. You want to stop it in its incipiency. Therefore, while it's still prevention, before it becomes lessening, interventions should occur. And also that competition means more than survival. So the fact that there are small businesses that are surviving within an industry doesn't mean that they're not being impeded or being prevented from being effective rivals. So just then, in conclusion, as pointed out earlier, conclusion on the next slide. You know, in South African law, we've only really had one case that looks at price discrimination at its core. There's a very limited provision for price discrimination in the first place, in that you have to show dominance, you have to show a lessening of and prevention of competition, and there are also various defenses that are available to respondents. But I think given South Africa's economy and its stage or the development stage that it's in, you still find that there are a lot of super dominant firms. You still find, you know, corporate conduct that runs along, you know, all boys networks, lobbying, etc. So I think even though you know, I think it will probably continue to be a very rare practice in terms of actual getting of cases. But given that context, it's also not surprising that we will see a few cases of price discrimination, even though, you know, it might be argued that, you know, your rational profit-maximizing firm shouldn't be doing this. It shouldn't have any interest in limiting competition downstream, given the nature and development of the economy and issues around being able, issues around ensuring that dominance isn't abused and entrenched, then you're likely in an economy such as this to still find one or two price discrimination cases. But nationwide polls obviously turned on the demonstration of substantial lessening or prevention of competition, with the tribunal and the appeals court espousing different standards. Now, as mentioned earlier, I mean, part of the problem in this specific case is the way the evidence emerged, or actually didn't emerge, because the commission hadn't referred the case. And it could be argued that had there been a better identification of markets, for example, not much work was done in defining the geographic market. And, you know, there's every reason to believe that if that had been done properly, you'd likely find that there are local markets for poles. No one, you know, drives around, you know, from Johannesburg, you know, from north of the country to sell poles to the south. But if you properly define the markets, you would find that in those markets, the CESL's conduct does very much limit the ability of vineyards to access poles at competitive prices, and that there's increased market power of local pole manufacturers within the Western Cape. But that left that depth of evidence and analysis hadn't been done in this case. So I guess the final remark would just be that, you know, they're kind of two open questions, and we really haven't answered them in the South African jurisprudence, given that we've only had one case. But I guess the open questions are, then, do you assess price discrimination in the Peterson third way, if you can call it that, where you only look at the prevention of competition and prevention as being something that can be inferred from the experience of one competitor, that if the evidence is valid, can be generalized? Or is the standard in the appeals court actually quite appropriate and something that could be met if the right kinds of analysis and the right kinds of evidence are placed in front of the appeals court? So that's still the outstanding question in terms of where price discrimination is going in South African jurisprudence. I think I'd like to stop there and take some questions and, take some questions.
Thank you, Trudy, for a very detailed discussion of a fascinating case. Let me ask Felix Engelsing, is head of the 10th Decision Division of the Bundeskartellamt, the German cartel office. How would this decision have been rendered, do you believe, under German law or under the European Commission competition law?
Yeah, Felix Engelsing from Germany. Well, I think the case law of the European Court and the German Court suggests that you don't have to show actual harm, but that you have to show a clear and convincing story of negative effects for the competitive process. So I think the question was a bit directed to would we have brought up the case. Well, I cannot speak for the European Commission. In Germany, I think we would have classified it more as a rebate case than price discrimination. So I see the point that Damien made, that a lot of price discrimination cases are labeled as price discrimination, but are actually fall in a different category. And I think we would there looked at whether this rebates here are more quantity rebates, which are in general okay, or a loyalty rebate. But actually, I'm not so much in detail. I do not know so much about the background of the cases, and I can understand it from the South African point of view that you also have to look at these small and medium-sized enterprises, which play an important role for the market structure, especially if you have high entry barriers in a market.
Thank you, Felix. Radoslav, what about Chile? Is this the sort of case that might have been brought in Chile?
Yes, this type of case may have been brought to the tribunal. Now, most probably, we would have decided as a court of appeals in South Africa, but for different reasons, because our Competition Act makes no distinction and says nothing about price discrimination specifically. We only have a broad definition of conducts infringing competition, and this definition comprises both conducts hindering or preventing competition from happening and those that directly lessen competition. So we have a lot of leeway there to use both criteria freely. And when dealing with a case like this one, we here in the tribunal focus first in generalized harm to the market. We do not look the harm to an individual competitor or to a specific consumer. Also, we prefer to look for long-term effects rather than short-term effects. Evidence is key and essential to produce our conviction and to indict or to penalize or not the case. And it is very important to point out that we give no particular consideration to small size competitors or to industrial policy factors. So maybe in this case we could have coincided with the Court of Appeals that it may be a case in which a particular competitor was being benefited rather than the market as a whole. And second, the lack of evidence would have brought us to the decision to dismiss the case.
Thank you. One issue that wasn't raised in this case, seemingly, was the issue of ultimate consumer welfare. The consumers who were purchasers of poles, the vineyards, or the ultimate downstream consumers, the buyers of wine, which are sold by vineyards. Does it, should, first of all, under Chilean or German law, is any attention given in a situation such as this, when there is alleged harm up the distribution chain, is any attention paid to ultimate consumer welfare, and should it be?
Well, I can, for Germany, I would say we do not actually look at ultimate consumer welfare. We look more at the competitive process. So does it really harm the competitive process? I mean, you can say if the entry barriers are low and some small and medium-sized exits the market, that's okay because new competitors can come in. But if entry barriers are high and those the least remaining small and medium-sized company exits the market, that would be bad for the market structure and also for the competitive process. So I think that's also the EU approach.
Here in Chile, we share Felix's approach. We look at the competitive process rather than consumer-specific welfare issues. So it's the same as in the EU and Germany.
Is there any question from the audience?
And ladies and gentlemen on the phone lines, if you'd like to ask a question, please remember to press *0 at this time. And if an operator's already taken your name, you can press *1. Our first question here will come from the line of Robin Noble. Please go ahead.
Hi, it's Robin Noble from Auxera. Just a question, really, for Trudy, following on from Damien Girardin's excellent presentation, was one of the points that he made was about the fact that price discrimination is an efficient outcome in competitive markets, and sometimes you don't really know quite why they do it, but they do it, and you see it quite widespreadly. So I was just interested in the comments that you made throughout your presentation about the lack of incentive that Sasol seemed to have engaged in this kind of behavior, and how heavily you think that that featured in the minds of the appeal court when they were making their decision.
Hi, thanks for that question. I think in terms of, the lack of evidence on Sasol, or rather, one could infer that there really isn't any rational reason on Sasol's behalf to be doing this. However, there was positive evidence on the industry that the buyers lobbying Cecil to discriminate against certain kinds of producers. There was one instance what they call the twilight producers, who were like really the micro producers in the pole industry, where the industry had approached Cecil and said, we don't think, you know, we want these guys in the industry, and they give it a bad reputation, etc. Could you price them out of the market? So I think in the face of that kind of evidence, and just in terms of the kinds of relationships that seem to have been happening between Cecil and its buyers, the fact that there wasn't a rationale, I don't think weighed that heavily, given kind of almost opposing evidence that shows that even without rationale, there is exclusionary intent, though not coming from Cecil itself, but the industry has been shown to engage in that. But of course, I would say in general, where there is, you know, evidence positive evidence of efficiency, then I think in that case, the outcome, the appeals court would have also thought about that. I think also another evidence point was that in terms of, I guess when you read what the judgments say about the record, there wasn't any kind of evidence of fraud or justification or strategy from Cecil for differentiating across the different bands. So it wasn't that we're trying to give a rebate to the highest volume off-takers for any particular reason. And also it was done on a historical basis. So I think the combination of those two facts made it difficult for anyone to see Cecil as having any efficiency reason for doing it. I would say I agree with Damian. I'm sure in other cases where there is evidence of thought and strategy and reasoning as to why you're giving it a differential pricing, then in that case, the same conclusion that appeals would have been reached.
Thank you very much, Trudy. If there are no further questions...
We do have one other question from the Alliance. Okay, we'll take that. It'll come from the line of Chuck Webb. Please go ahead.
Yes, hi. Can you hear me?
Yep, your line's
okay, thanks. It seems like the demand, nationwide demand to purchase creosol depended on the amount of volume that they're selling, that nationwide itself is selling to poles and vineyards. So there's some kind of correlation between its demand to purchase creosol and the number of poles it's selling to its own customers. I'm just curious, in this case, was there any evidence that if Nationwide increased its own sales of poles, let's say if Nationwide itself competed more vigorously in the downstream market and therefore had an increased demand for creosol, it would have benefited from the same lower prices that its larger competitors benefited from?
Okay. Thanks. Clearly the way the pricing schedule worked was on historical volume. So if they had been able to increase their demand of creosote and output of poles, it could have pushed them to into a higher price band, and therefore they would have been able to get favorable pricing. However, I think in this case there was a bit of there's a bit of a direction of causation issue there, because the discrimination kept, or they would have argued that the discrimination kept them in the lower bracket, and therefore they couldn't, given their cost structure, they weren't able to increase their output. I think, and the other thing is that they only discovered, you know, the whole dynamics about how the market works afterwards. So they didn't really know, before that this is how the pricing works. So it wasn't as if this is an incentive from Cecil for people to be more productive, increase production, etc. It was more that there was a practice that was kind of opaque to Nationwide, and that they felt that it kept them at the lower level, that they were unable to a bigger price band. That's kind of just reconstructing what happened there. But I think, obviously, if they had found some other way of increasing their price band, logically, from what we see, they should have then been able to benefit from that price, from a lower price, even though I guess they wouldn't have really known what that lower price is.
Thank you.
And no further questions from the phone lines at this time.
Good. Thank you very much. Let's now turn to the next slide. Price discrimination affecting a Russian fertilizer market, a presentation by Vladimir Kachalin, Assistant to the President, FAS Russia.
Thank you, Alden. Well, indeed, I would like to contribute to this discussion by presenting the case of price discrimination in the market for the raw materials for the fertilizer production, that is actually apatite concentrate, that is the product in question. And I would like to proceed with a very brief description of the legal framework applied to the consideration of this case. Actually, all the unilateral abuses are addressed by Article 10 of the Russian law on competition protection, including price discrimination. And the criteria for the violation to be established are first, that company should be dominant, that its behavior result or can result in prevention, restriction, or elimination of competition, that is, it should have restrictive effects applicable to the market in general and not to the particular competitor, and also may lead to infringement of interests of other persons that are presumed the consumers. And after this preamble, the whole list of unilateral violations is provided, including price discrimination that is defined as economically, technologically, or by other way unjustified establishment of different prices or tariffs for one and the same commodity for different customers. So efficiency-based defenses do not apply to price discrimination, although to some other unilateral practices they can be applied according to Article 13 of the law of competition protection. So in this case, the only possible defense for a apatite company, that is a company who was alleged in price discrimination, was a reference to economical, technical, or other valid reasons for price discrimination, such as, let's say, for instance, distance to a particular customer, or servicing an additional customer that may involve additional costs. But this was not the circumstances of this particular case. So apatite could not use those as defenses. For the moment, the Russian Federal Anti-Monopoly Service prepared a new legal initiative called the so-called Third Antitrust Package, according to which price discrimination can be considered as on the basing on the effect-based approach and the influence of this practice on the consumer welfare. However, the this legal initiative is under consideration now. It was passed to the government, and then it will be further considered by the parliament. So we'll see what the final wording of the law will be, and whether it will provide for a possibility to consider price discrimination on the basing on the effect-based approach and the influence of this practice on consumer welfare. For the moment, this is not possible in Russia. Having said this, let me pass to the consideration of the case itself. And this brings us to slide number 28. It is about market definition and dominant assessment. In this particular case, the definition of product market was not so complicated because phosphate-based fertilizers cannot be cost-effectively substituted with other types of chemical fertilizers in Russia, and apatite concentrate is used for production of these phosphate-based fertilizers and cannot be substituted in their production as well. As far as the geographic market is concerned, there is only one developed natural deposit of apatite in the European part of Russia that is used for apatite extraction, enriching the apatite and converting it into apatite concentrate that is sold in the market to the downstream fertilizer producers. The use of apatite from other parts of the country, let's say from eastern part of the country or from abroad, is not efficient because of prohibitively high transportation costs. For the moment, the government considers the possibility of making a tender for the development of a new apatite deposit also in the European part of Russia, but the tender has not yet been announced, and now it's a problem to find investors who would like to proceed to the development of this deposit. And apatite company that is the alleged violator actually was the first to express its interest in deposing this, in developing this natural deposit. So even if it is released for development, the effect of this decision on competition would be ambivalent unless apatite is not recommended or somehow legally precluded from participating in the development of the new deposit. So apatite controls actually all the facilities and natural and natural deposits currently used for commercial distribution of apatite concentrate. Actually, it's 90% of the value of all the apatite deposited in Russia, in the European part of Russia, but the remaining 10% is used by the company that does not distribute it commercially and use for its own purposes. And moreover, apatite company was entered in the list of dominant companies that FAS maintained basing on the market surveys. Obviously, apatite is dominant and moreover having almost 100% monopoly in production of apatite concentrate in European part of Russia. So, from a certain moment of time, about three, four years ago, it started to charge different prices to its own daughter companies and independent producers of fertilizers, charging about from 20 to 30% different difference in prices established for its own subsidiaries and independent producers. This price discrimination was accompanied with a practice known as kind of constructive refusal to deal, such as interruptions in shipments and conclusion of agreements with independent fertilizer producers on disadvantaged conditions and not providing for obligations of a apatite company to make shipments in due time and in due quantity. So it's led to frequent production stoppages and interruptions, and therefore growth in costs of the independent fertilizer producers, and also was accompanied by margin squeeze caused both by the excessive price for apatite concentrate for independent producers and by costly production stoppages, because it's costly indeed for this type of production to shut down facilities, preserve them, keep for some time idle, and then launch again. Through those practices, apatite obviously sought to monopolize the downstream market, and the changes in the market structure provide a certain evidence of that. In 3 years, the number of independent producers reduced from 6 to 4, and totally there are 8 now. And in our opinion, this provides the evidence of anti-competitive and restrictive circumstances of consequences of apatite practices. Remarkably, this constructive refusals to deal ended when independents agreed to be acquired by apatite, and then the two companies, two independent companies, joined apatite holding. They started to receive the raw materials on regular basis at acceptable price. However, the price of increase for apatite concentrate was not passed over to the ultimate customers of fertilizers, the farmers, due to the competition in downstream fertilizers market, since there was apatite daughters who was constrained in price raising by presence of independent companies, as well as by FIS merger remedies imposed in the course of authorization of vertical mergers between apatite and independent producers acquired by it. And FIS also issued a kind of warning to the fertilizer production producers that it will initiate the case against them collectively or individually in case of the raise of prices in socially vulnerable fertilizer markets, since the cost of fertilizers will be certainly passed to the basing alimentation products and to consumers. FIS undertook certain enforcement action and remedies described in the slide number 30. That first of all provided for a uniform agreed-on price established for all sales of apatite concentrate regardless of the customer, whether it was independent company or apatite daughter company. So the price was calculated on the basing on the last year price that was considered as kind of a base price multiplied by inflation ratio and the so-called depletion ratio, that is the annual increase in cost of extraction of apatite due to the deterioration of the natural deposit of apatite. So the base price was calculated as total cost of production inputs plus reasonable overheads plus cost of capital, and actually it was taken rather close to the pre-violation price. Another condition included in the FIS injunction provided that the price for apatite daughter companies can be 5% less compared to that for the independent companies due to the absence of transaction costs. In a certain moment of time, FIS attempted to arrange sales of apatite concentrate via the commodity exchange, but apatite company continued its abusing practices there as well by a reduction of volume of concentrate sold in the exchange and providing it only to its daughter companies and not to the independent companies. And this converted the exchange in the kind of auction and led to the very substantial price increase in the market. So eventually the agency had to return to its original injunction providing for the uniform agreed on price.
Perhaps at this point, thank you very much, Vladimir. We're unfortunately a bit short on time. You've described a remedy. I wonder if, which is anybody would like to comment, Radoslav or Felix, about this sort of remedy. Is this the sort of remedy that you might undertake in Chile or in Germany?
Well, Felix Engelsing, well, first let me say, I think we would have classified this as a margin squeeze case and not as a price discrimination case, because I think in Germany and in Europe, you have a kind of concern privilege, which means that you can charge lower prices from subsidiaries than from independent downstream producers. So I think the approach would have been more to look at what are the prices charged from apatite company from the independent producers compared with the prices from the subsidiaries charged to the end consumers. And is there a margin squeeze? And the other, I mean, that's what one question for Vladimir. Did you ever look at this as a margin squeeze case? And then I also didn't exactly understand the 5% transaction costs. I mean, that seemed to be, I didn't understand this figure.
Okay. So actually, Felix, we do not use the definition of the margin squeeze in our competition law. And actually, historically, especially in the steel industry and in fertilizer industry and in other industries, setting up different prices for own subsidiaries and independent companies was very frequently used indeed for coercing the independent companies to agree for being purchased by the upstream producers, and thus it led to the restriction of competition of in the downstream market. So theoretically, it certainly has such kind of practice certainly has characteristics of margin squeeze, but we do not have or use the legal definition of the margin squeeze, although it looks very much like a margin squeeze, and the purposes of this practice is very much the same as in the margin squeeze. As far as 5% difference is concerned, so eventually all of the stakeholders, including FIS, independent companies, Apatite, and its daughter companies, agree that Apatite can sell its concentrate to its own daughter companies at a price that will be 5% less than that set for the independent companies. Due to the absence of transaction costs, that is, cost for concluding the deal, solving possible disputes legally, and so on. So this was a difference, actually, all the stakeholders agreed on, and in many industries, in fact, transaction costs, that is costs for concluding the deal, finding customer and making all the necessary legal arrangements and so on, may be quite considerable. This 5% was actually allowed for the absence of transaction costs.
Thank you.
Yeah, in the case of Chile, we most probably would not adopt this price control approach. The Chilean tribunal is reluctant to impose price control measures due mainly to both design and implementation. I think that we consider that the risk of making a mistake when determining the applicable price is very high, mainly because the cost information that would be provided by the defendant may not be reliable. That's the first reason. And second, and also very important, is that permanent monitoring of the controlled price and of its variations is difficult and costly. And third, in those cases in which the only possible solution is to regulate the market, in those cases the tribunal chooses to propose to government to pass an act granting the executive branch the power to regulate with issuing decrees the prices in that market, but those cases are very few. In telecoms, in certain services, in telecommunications, it happens like that. But in general cases, the tribunal prefers to impose a fine, to order the defendant to cease and desist its price discrimination conduct, and rely in the prosecuting agency, the Fiscalía Nacional Económica, and in the other competitors or participants in the market to carry on the monitoring. Just to let us know if there is a new infringement to our order not to sit in the discrimination or in the squeeze margin squeeze that is, we agree with Felix. This is a case of margin squeeze rather than a case of price discrimination. So, and an additional measure that has been adopted in some cases is to order the defendant to charge all its clients using a most favored nation standard. Thus, we impose to the defendant the obligation to disclose and make public prices charged to all its clients. So that's how we would have dealt with a case like this one in Chile. Thanks.
Thank you, Radoslav. I think, unfortunately, we have to close now, but we will have a special extra short presentation. First, I want to thank Radoslav and Felix, our expert commentators, and I want to thank Vladimir and Trudy for their excellent presentations. I would like to ask Markus Lange of the Bundeskartellamt if he's available, if he has anything to add.
Thank you very much, Alden. Just very briefly, I would also like to thank all speakers and panelists, and you know, for their contributions, for their discussions, and I would like to thank you, Alden, very much for leading us through this illuminating discussion, which has really shown us the intricacies of dealing with price discrimination and just the problem of establishing, first of all, whether we should call the animal price discrimination or choose some other name, like margin squeeze or whatever it is in the individual case. I think the discussion has provided us with some very useful thoughts for our ICN members and for our NGAs on the call, and thoughts for deciding how to actually handle the cases that come before us. So thank you very much, and thank you also to our listeners for contributing, for asking questions, and for staying with us. Well, so much for me for now, please let us know how you experienced today's teleseminar by giving us your comments by email to Jan Lorbeck and Cynthia Lagdameo, who are listed with their email addresses on the ICN website, and so we would be very happy to have your feedback. So thank you very much again from me, and now I would like to I would like to pass the floor to Randy.
Thanks, Marcus. This is Randy Tritel from the FTC, and we have, as indicated, a treat, a bonus for those who can stay with us a few more minutes. Recall that last year the working group examined margin squeeze practices, leading to a report on how margin squeeze is treated around the world. And as we've heard today, issues in price discrimination can also bring up the possibility of analyzing the same set of facts under margin squeeze. And it turns out that just a couple of weeks ago, on February 17th, there was an important decision from the European Court of Justice on the legal issue of margin squeeze. So we thought we would take a few minutes at the end of this teleseminar and provide an update to you from DG Comp on that decision. So it is now my pleasure to introduce from DG Comp Ekaterina Ruseva. Ekaterina is a case handler in DG Comp, and she's also conducted extensive research on exclusionary practices, leading to the publication of several articles and even a book on the subject. So I'm going to now turn over the floor to Ekaterina to tell us about the Telia Sonera margin squeeze case.
Hello, everybody. I would first start with the clarification, with the important clarification, I think, that when we're dealing with margin squeeze cases, we don't qualify them as discriminatory type of practices. We believe that where a dominant firm is vertically integrated and offers better conditions to itself than to its customers, with which it also competes, it is arguable whether the dominant undertaking's downstream operation and customers are in the same position or whether they are comparable at all, whether we are facing equal transactions. We also, and even if the dominant undertaking offers equal conditions, we still may face a margin squeeze cases. Therefore, we prefer to look at a margin squeeze case, a type of exclusionary practice, without adding any label related to discriminatory practice or pricing. Now, turning to the case itself, the background of this case is a reference for a preliminary ruling from the Stockholm District Court in Sweden in the course of proceedings between the Swedish telecom operator Telia Sonera and the National Competition Authority. The referring court asked the Court of Justice a series of about 10 questions on the interpretation of Article 102 of the Treaty on the Functioning of the European Union concerning alleged abuse of a dominant position in the form of a margin squeeze. The issues in the main proceedings arose in the context of a technological change at the end of the 90s, when a growing number of Swedish end users on the internet services moved from digital up internet connections to various types of broadband connections with considerably higher transmission speeds. At the time, the most widespread form of broadband connection was achieved by asymmetrical digital subscriber line. And historically, Telia Sonera has been the Swedish fixed telephone network operator, the holder of, in the past, of exclusive rights and also the owner of the local loop. What is important is that Telia Sonera offers to rivals unbundled access under legal obligation, but also it offers ADCL products for wholesale users without being legally obliged to do so. And this is the aspect of the case which distinguishes it from previous cases in the telecom sector that we had, like Deutsche Telekom and Telefonica. The allegation in the case was that Telia Sonera abused its dominant position on the wholesale market by applying a margin squeeze between the wholesale price for the input ADSL products and the retail price services, which was insufficient to cover its incremental costs. If we could move to the next slide, I'll be short with that. Here I have listed the various questions that the National Court posed to the European Court of Justice. It they go to the fundamentals, actually, of the margin squeeze, requiring the court to give a clear guidance on the test applicable to margin squeeze practices. And we can move to the next slide, please. No? Well, the message of the court, the most important message of the court is that first, it confirms the position already taken in previous decision by the court in Deutsche Telekom that a margin squeeze constitutes an abuse as long as it is likely to exclude competitors who are at least as efficient as the dominant undertaking. The court pointed out that in this particular case there would be such an abusive margin squeeze where the spread of the wholesale price and the retail price for the broadband services are either negative or insufficient to cover Telia Sonera's specific cost on the retail market. The court further confirmed that for a margin squeeze to exist, it is not necessary that the wholesale price or the excessive price on the retail market are excessive or predatory, respectively. It also confirmed that as a general rule in the assessment, account should be taken primarily of the prices and the cost of the dominant undertaking, and only where it is impossible, we can refer to the cost and the prices of competitors. This is something which is not new. We already knew it from the Deutsche Telekom ruling. And although the court points out that effects, the established effects, don't need to be concrete, its rulings leaves no doubt that at least a potential anti-competitive exclusionary effect affecting as efficient competitor needs to be demonstrated. From this perspective, all these statements made by the courts are fully aligned with Section 3C of our guidance paper on the Commission's enforcement priority in applying Article 102 to exclusionary practices. If we can move to the next slide. What is interesting in the ruling is that the ICJ, the European Court of Justice, said that it would not consider indispensability to be always necessary when we establish abusive margin squeeze. Although it emphasized that it is important and it would be the first thing that would be considered, it said that we might have situations and scenarios in which we may have abusive margin squeeze even if the wholesale input is not indispensable. In such circumstances, however, the court still insists that the National Competition Authority or court should establish anti-competitive effect affecting as efficient competitors. So from this perspective, the test that the court suggests is a little bit less stringent than the test that we have in the guidance paper. But nevertheless, the overall approach of the court, we find this aligned or supports our general framework of analysis of exclusionary conduct. If we can move to the next slide. We also believe that the court supports, the ruling suggests that the court supports an effects-based approach, evident from the observation that while the degree of dominance might not be relevant for the finding of an abuse, because for finding of an abuse, mere dominance is sufficient, the court says that the degree of dominance is significant in relation to the establishment of the effects of the conduct. On the other hand, similar to the position taken already by the court in Microsoft case, the ICJ confirms that finding of an abuse does not require that the dominant undertaking on the wholesale upstream market be also dominant in the downstream retail market. The court considers that no difference should be made depending on whether the practice drives out of the market customers who are already established on the market or potential customers. The reason that the harmed competition may be caused not only by deteriorating the existing competition, but also by creating barriers to entry, which may make it more difficult for potentially equal efficient competitors to enter the market. And if we move to the next slide, the other questions that the court touched upon is first that the dominant undertaking, does, we don't need to prove or to show that the dominant undertaking is able to recoup its losses. This was something already said by the court in France, Telecom, a predatory pricing case where the court held that recoupment does not need to be proved in order to establish predatory pricing. A fortiori, we can say that we could expect that it would be true for margin squeeze case, and also this is aligned with the court's position that we may have a margin squeeze as an independent abuse irrespective of whether the retail price is predatory or not. The court considered also that the fact that the markets are concerned and mature or rapidly growing, requiring higher level of investment, is not in general relevant to the establishing whether the practice constitutes an abuse. The court believed that the dominant undertaking cannot rely on the investment it has made in order to exclude an equally efficient competitor. However, the court would not ignore investments made by the dominant undertaking and would take them into account in the cost analysis related to establishing whether margin squeeze exists in the first place. And finally, the court seems to dispel any remaining doubts as to the importance of efficiency justification for the assessment of practices that may have exclusionary effects. The court underpinned that exclusionary effects, which are disadvantages for competitors, may be counterbalanced or outweighed by advantages in terms of efficiency, which, however, also need to benefit the consumer. In a nutshell, to conclude, the last slide would be great if we have. Well, the court seems to confirm that the margin squeeze is an independent abuse subjected to as efficient competitor test. We believe that the court supports the commission's effects-based approach and general framework of analysis of exclusionary conduct as prescribed in our guidance paper. The novelty for us seems to be that the condition for indispensability does not need to be established, and by saying that, the court seems to distinguish margin squeeze from refusals to deal. This is all I can say very briefly, given the time that we have.
Thank you, Ekaterina, for an excellent summary of a very important European case. At this stage, I think I want to thank everyone again, including my colleague Cynthia Lagdameo, who was instrumental in putting this together, the heads of the international departments, if you will, of the Bundeskartellamt, Markus Lange and Randy Tritel of the FTC, and our distinguished participants and questioners from the audience. And again, all of the materials will be posted on the ICN website. We look forward to your comments, and we wish everyone a good day.
Thank you. And that does conclude our conference for today. Thank you for your participation and for using AT&T Executive Teleconference Service. You may now disconnect.
Thank you for calling the AT&T Teleconference Replay System.